Welcome to Decaf and Debunk, a podcast all about busting myths and bringing light to popular and sometimes confusing topics in nutrition and health, because we all could use a little less caffeine and a little more science.
And we are your hosts, Hope
and Jesse.
And today we're going to be demystifying some of the things around the word diet. And we're going to be talking a little bit about how we define diet and what that looks like for us as dietitians. So, Jesse, do you want to get us started by sharing how you define diet in your day-to-day life, or even maybe how it comes up in your job differently than in your home life?
Yeah, one of the big things when we start to think about diet, so that term is so layered, but diet itself to me as a nutrition researcher, it's probably evolved in what it's really meant to me over the years. But diet as a nutritionist and a nutrition researcher means the pattern in which someone eats. So that's what it means to me. Now we could break down, like, there's a lot of different layers of what we would consider to be a diet. So as a researcher, diet, again, just the pattern in which someone eats. But as a public audience understands it more, it's a way that an individual would eat in a purposeful way, whether that's to achieve a health goal, lose weight, or any of the above. So that's kind of how I think about diet. I think it's gotten like a little misconstrued in with what it means. So I throw around a diet as like, I eat this way, so this is my diet. But it's not actually like a restrictive diet. I think most of the time people, when we think of diet, we think of it as being like, oh, like a restrictive, purposeful thing that we go on to achieve a health goal or lose weight.
Yeah, I think even in my day-to-day life, when I talk with people or they learn that I'm a dietitian, the immediate connotation is, oh, can you teach me how to eat healthy, or can you give me a diet? I mean, that's even in the name of our profession. But I do really think that for me, when I first started thinking about diets, even now, if I say the word diet and something pops into my head, it's rules. It's related to rules, like what you're supposed to be doing or what you're not supposed to be doing, versus, like you said, from a research perspective or from a nutrition perspective, it's really just about the pattern that you're eating, right? If you're going into a session or talking with someone in general, you'd be kind of asking, so tell me a little bit about your diet, not tell me what diet you're on, right? Those are two different things. But I do think you're right that it's become a bit misconstrued, that now there's always the connotation of some types of rules or restrictions, things you can and can't do.
Yeah. And then you start get into the muddy waters of thinking about, there are therapeutic diets, so regimented ways of eating, that are absolutely necessary for some individuals. And I think a lot of people got a little bit confused with the increase in like anti-diet dietitians and people on social media. And I think the terminology gets really confusing, because at the root of it, what an anti-diet dietitian really is someone that's against fad dieting. There are absolutely therapeutic diets, and even the anti-diet dietitians online would agree that, yes, there are diets that we want to put people on to achieve specific health goals that are therapeutic in nature. And so I think it's just gotten a little bit confusing with that. There's definitely a lot of purpose in having diets. And I think that's where people get really confused, especially when working one-on-one with individuals and people are wanting to approach things from a more health at every size, intuitive eating, anti-diet kind of approach. And maybe they need a therapeutic diet. It's really hard to navigate some of those conversations with them, because now they have I don't want to go on a diet. Well, we're going to try to step into this and not think of it as a rigid diet, but think of it more as we're going to make some health decisions and decisions with the way in which we're eating that are going to be therapeutic in nature, and treat it more as a therapy and not a like punishment. But there's a lot of times where it's like, we know this food makes us feel like absolute crap, and so we can't eat it. I deal a lot with that in the gut health realm. There are absolutely therapeutic diets that we can be utilized in the GI realm. And so one of those is the low FODMAP diet, which if no one to go on a little tangent, I ask my students this all the time, but if you're unaware, the low FODMAP diet, so FODMAP is an acronym that stands for fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols, basically just means fermentable small carbohydrates. And what that really means is your gut microbes really like these small carbohydrates. And when they pass through our GI tract and maybe we don't absorb them properly, or we have the specific microbes that exist within our gut, they metabolize it. They have a heyday. They produce a lot of gas. That feels really crappy for some individuals, not everyone. And so what the low FODMAP diet does is it is a strict elimination, very regimented elimination diet in order to figure out what food is causing you to have these issues. And so that is very, that could lead people down because it's strict, just like a fad diet is strict, and it could lead down a path of disordered eating if not taken into appropriate care. And I guess that brings up a point that we would want to make with this kind of thing is like a lot of the therapeutic diets that are utilized under the guidance of a trained professional, like a registered mm-hmm. dietitian, because one difference with fad diet is a lot of time you're taking that on yourself. And that puts a lot of the burden on you. And we talked about in our last podcast how that can lead to kind of a blame and shame cycle of if you don't do something right, then you're the problem. And if it's not working, then you're the problem. Mm-hmm. But what the benefit of having a trained eye on when you're implementing a therapeutic diet is that we're able to look at things objectively and we're not living in your body. So we're not feeling the same things that you're feeling, but we have an outside view and we can kind of look at what we think is really going on without having kind of the feelings aspect come into it, which is still definitely important, but it's nice to also have that objective point of view.
Yeah. And that actually makes me think also about the purpose that you could have for a diet in general. I think that it's gotten morphed with the general population that the role of a diet is to lose weight. And mm-hmm. if we come at it from our professional perspective, we are looking at so many other factors of health that a diet can help with. Like, for example, when you said with the low FODMAP diet, that could also just be some uncomfortable GI feelings that someone's having. And when those feelings are gone, their weight might not change. They might not have ever had any abnormal metabolic markers, but they are feeling so much better because the GI discomfort that they were feeling has subsided with this diet. Mm-hmm. So I think that the purpose also of those diets has been narrowed so far. And it's unfortunately, I think, made it seem like it has to be very, very complicated to approach feeling better and listening to your body and choosing what foods to eat because they make us feel good or don't feel good, because there's always some other alternate, you know, I have to lose weight or I have to have this change. Maybe the change is as simple as I feel a lot better when I don't eat those things.
Yeah, absolutely. So what is, and I because I want to rant a little bit, and I know we're going to do this some on the podcast. So we've touched a little bit on our thoughts on therapeutic diets and where we kind of think diets fit in our definition kind of things. But what is like one fad diet that you've seen that like absolutely enrages you? Because I want to answer this too, so I'm asking you.
I think that, oh my gosh. Well, to start, a lot, but I think that the one that probably enrages me the most because of the area of my research is the fad of dairy is bad for you. Like you have to avoid all dairy. You have to, and coming from a human milk researcher, I'm like, wait a second, we are throwing the baby out with the bathwater here. There's so many good things that come from dairy. Does that mean I think you should pound a whole wheel of cheese? Probably not. I mean, also your stomach is going to be probably pretty upset if you do that. But I think that is one of the biggest ones because it's also milk is so unique in that it has so much bang for your buck in the terms of nutritional content. You know, even if you were like, had a child that was picky, if you can get them to drink milk, I'm like, okay, we're good. You know, you have something mm-hmm. that covers a lot of bases. So I feel like that one makes me maybe more angry than some other ones, because I'm like, we have so many good things that come from dairy. So plus yeah. I love cheese.
Our research expertise and biases are probably showing a little bit in our like preferences of or hatreds of different diets for sure.
I was going to say, is yours like gut related?
Essentially. So I think the one that's enraging me the most right now, and we will do a whole series on the dumbest diets ever on this podcast, and we'll break down individual diets and talk about why we think they're BS and things like that. But for my realm, the one that's really enraging me currently is the carnivore diet. Really just because it's so, if anyone listening is unfamiliar, it's exactly what it sounds like, is a diet that is essentially based in meat products only, and animal products only. And there are people that tout and push the carnivore diet that have even gone a step further and basically start demonizing things like fiber and vegetables really? And fruits and things that we have decades and decades and decades of research to show that these things are beneficial, not only for our gut health, for our cardiovascular health, for mm-hmm. overall metabolic health, everything. And you're essentially telling someone that those are toxic to the, like, to the body. Mm-hmm. And the really tricky thing about a lot of these diets is people who share about them and push them use the, like, they find a sliver of truth of science and then they exploit that. And that's one of the characteristics all of bad diets, is that they get you to buy in because they mm-hmm. find a characteristic of science that sounds good. It sounds legit. It sounds physiologically possible. Or they find a cell culture research study that's not ever done in humans. It's done in a petri dish, and they find this finding and then they just shoot it out like it's 100% applicable to our full human yes. biology.
That and is the carnivore true. Diet
has definitely done that with a lot of, like, there are toxins that are within your plant foods and anti-nutrients. Yes, plants have compounds that exist within them, including fiber, that can inhibit or lessen the nutrient absorption of different other compounds that exist within those different micronutrients. Does that mean they're like completely obliterating the amount of nutrients you're absorbing? No. And yeah. they're not toxic. And yeah. so I feel like that's one big thing that just enrages me, because with the carnivore diet, and there's a lot of people on social media that are doing the good work and sharing and breaking this down that I've seen. But we've seen people that have been on this that come in and their cholesterol is through the roof and their triglycerides are through the roof. And all in the name of, like, a lot of times they'll latch on to, like, well, my insulin doesn't spike, like, insulin right. levels are normalized. My glucose doesn't spike as much. And it's like, but you have all these other things going on too.
Right.
So,
and the, yeah. actually I think that the diet of avoiding dairy is probably fits well into the, like, camp of an anti-inflammatory diet is basically, yeah. I think, where it came from. And the same thing that you just said about finding the sliver of truth, is it true that for some people dairy can cause inflammation? Definitely. So, like, finding that one piece that they can latch onto and then broadly stroking that to cover mm-hmm. every single thing that is similar and or has the same nutritional content, right? Mm-hmm. Is really very dangerous because we know that there's so many ways that milk is processed into other dairy products that change the way it interacts with your body, changes what you absorb, changes what nutrients are available. Maybe they become more bioavailable, less bioavailable. So it is, and that's the scariest part, is that when the people are talking about it or presenting it, they have found the one piece that they, the one leg that they can stand on. Mm-hmm. And for when you don't have the background, the full breadth of training, it's easy to look at it and say,
yeah,
oh yeah, that's true. I mean, I see that it's true.
Yeah. I would say one, like, and I have experience with this, one downfall that helped contribute to my development of an eating disorder at the, I'm going to date myself a little bit, because at the time, social media was not a huge thing. We had like Facebook and stuff like that, but nothing really else. But we had magazines. Magazines were a big thing. And that's where you were learning about all the diets and magazines. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that kind of spurred me down like a negative path with that is there are so many different fad diets. And they all have usually like a sliver of truth that exists at their root core that gets that, you know, broadly painted and extrapolated and applied improperly. And it would seem like every single one that I would read about in all of these health and fitness magazines would tell me that I needed to do something else to better my health or cut out mm-hmm. a different food to better my health. And when you start to look at those as the consumer all together and you hear all of those conflicting messages, you eventually get to the point where your brain is overwhelmed. And I started eliminating all of those foods.
Everything.
And then eventually I had nothing else to eat because mm-hmm. everything was going to kill me. Everything mm-hmm. was going to give me cancer. Everything was going to cause so much inflammation in my body. And so you get really confused on like what actually is truth. Because all of these fad diets are so different. And that's something mm-hmm. else we see with the fad diets too, is there's camps, there's polarizing camps that exist within these fad diets. I talked about the carnivore diet. So that's one, you know, eating only animal products, just meat, like all that kind of that area of thing. You can go to the other side and you can have someone that's 100% raw vegan, only plants, only in a certain area, or yes. even like further extreme, like a fruitarian who only eats fruit products. Mm-hmm. And you have these two camps that are like, my diet is the best for health. No, my diet is the best for health. And they're just arguing back and forth at each other. And that is the consumer is incredibly
confusing.
And that
I was going to say is the other really interesting thing I find is that with all of the fad diets is that the consumers are all generalizing what possibly worked for one person to the entire human population. It's one person that said, I lost 40 pounds in 3 weeks, or I did, you know, suddenly I had no symptoms of inflammation, or whatever the claim is. And mm-hmm. that totally could have been true for that person. But that we know from a scientific perspective, this is why we have large ends in our or sample size in our research, because mm-hmm. you have to try it on lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of people to decide, okay, maybe this is true on a larger scale for the human body. And almost every single fad diet could probably be traced back to one person that was like, wow, I see that this is something that works, or that, and magazines, like you said, when we were younger, the one person on the cover, that one person that said that this was the diet that worked for them.
Which was probably a lie anyways.
It might have been. Or they were a celebrity and they can afford to hire someone to be their personal trainer for 8 hours a day. So it probably wasn't the diet at all.
Yeah. I'm sitting here thinking of, and they still sell them in the grocery stores. Like, I don't even remember what the magazines are called, but they're all targeted towards women, which is another thing we could get into. You don't see fad diets targeted towards men quite as much as you see them targeted towards women. But it's just like, I drop 40 pounds in 2 weeks. And it's like, that's not physiologically possible.
It's not possible. Yeah. And that is one of the pieces that when you get a well-trained nutrition professional, even if there's some amount of disordered thought in the background of that individual, to be able to challenge the reality, right? If you're working with someone that says, well, but it did work because in the past 2 days, I've lost 4 pounds. It's not actually physiologically possible to lose 4 pounds of tissue in that short of a time, which means that your body lost liquid weight, right? So being able to even contextualize that for someone, is it possible that the scale changed this much? Yeah, it could also be that you had a large dinner and your dinner weighed 2.7 pounds when you put it into your body, and then you, you know, were able to metabolize it, excrete what you didn't need, and now you don't have a full stomach. That alone could be, mm-hmm. I mean, you're going to laugh. We're going to end up talking about poop on this podcast. I know
I
that
was,
we are.
I literally had poop in my brain right then.
And I was like, I tell parents of babies that they're like nervous about weight gain, nervous. I'm like, if you even weigh a baby before and after they have a poopy diaper, you could be totally like, so this is why we can't obsess over these tiny little increments, because my scale when I go to visit a family is like sensitive enough that we can't change the diaper if they go to the bathroom because it will throw off the entire assessment. So, mm-hmm. but it is like, it's that context that you can give as a nutrition professional, I feel like, and why fad diets go so far in the other direction.
Yeah. And one thing that brings up like the water weight thing, that this is a fad diet that continues to re-evolve itself, is just basically eating low carb. And so back in the day we had, and there were probably even further back in the day prior to this, but we had like the Atkins diet, which was a low carb diet. And then it evolved and went away for a little period of time. And then we had the keto diet. And now we have carnivore, which is also now low carb. And so we have all of these like re-evolving diets that all get back at the same thing. And one big thing is usually a lot of fad diets, not all of them. Now we have a lot of people that are interested in like the longevity bit, and we can talk about that on another podcast, but a lot of them are really focused on weight loss. Mm-hmm. Pretty much most fad diets are focused on some form of weight loss. And one easy way to drop water weight is to cut out carbohydrate, because your body stores carbohydrate as glycogen. And with glycogen, we store water. And so when yes. we deplete the body of carbohydrate and we deplete the body of glycogen, we also are losing water. Mm-hmm. So water weight, that's an easy
and
way
water's
to
heavy.
Drop. Yes, water is heavy.
Water is heavy. Like, I mean, geez, when we do our backpacking, my least favorite part is filling the water bladder and putting it in, because I'm like, dang, 2 liters of water, that's going to bump up my weight like 12 pounds, whatever. But water yeah. is heavy, and that is how fad diets end up selling so well, because it looks like a magic bullet of like, whoa, mm-hmm. okay. It's going to normalize. Also, you can't be dehydrated for an extended period of time. So
yeah.
you will eventually figure out how to like consume water again, and it will normalize. But
that also
why...
feeds into the shame cycle too, because you lose that weight so quickly when you mm-hmm. cut out carbohydrate, because you're losing some of that water weight. The second you add a carbohydrate back in, your body's like, thank God.
I know.
And it's going to store glycogen. It's going to store water, and your weight's mm-hmm. going to spike on the scale, and you're going to be like, what did I do? I screwed up. And you could have eaten something as benign as like a piece of fruit. And that is going to do the same thing. I know, a banana. And they're going to be like, bananas made me gain weight. You put glycogen back on your body.
And that literally actually breaks down to like one of the most important things, I feel like, in understanding nutrition, is that if your calories in is greater than your calories out, it does not matter if all of those calories are bananas. It doesn't matter if all those calories are apples. It doesn't matter if all those calories are cake. It is all going to be broken down by your body. Your body's going to try to figure out a way to get what it needs. So
I hate to break it to the biohackers, but they're not outsmarting the laws of thermodynamics.
No,
like, it's just not happening.
It doesn't work like that. And I think also one thing that gets missed is the actual like baseline knowledge of what's happening with your metabolism, because the people that actually think, for example, that you can force your body to stay in a certain state, actually, this is another big pet peeve of mine, is alkaline water, because I'm not going to say that it doesn't help alleviate an acidic, like an acid reflux potentially for some people, but your stomach is going to produce more acid so that the pH comes down. I mean, there's no way to outsmart your body. If you don't give your body glucose, it's going to break down other things to get glucose. Okay. So you can't really trick, like I'm never going to trick my stomach to not have a pH of, you know, 2. I'm just not. That's not not permanently.
No.
So, and that's the part that gets missed, because if I actually could change the pH of my body, we would be in trouble because I would mm-hmm. die. Like, you would yeah. be so out of homeostasis that you would literally have a heart attack and die.
Yeah. And that's something that applies to a lot of different fad diets that then get at like the health aspect. So if we're really nitpicky on focusing on certain health markers, and so I'm thinking like inflammation here, mm-hmm. if you really could control very tightly, there's definitely dietary habits you can choose that are more anti-inflammatory. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. But if you could micromanage the level of inflammation or the level of oxidation and reactive oxygen species within your body to such a finite level, we would be in trouble, because then the burden would be on us to continually micromanage that. And that's not possible. And we right. would probably all die.
Right. And yeah. that actually kind of transitions to my next kind of thought, was, when are diets a good thing? Like, when do we utilize those? But that
yeah.
in and of itself is the logic, is that if we are supporting our body functioning well, right? Like you said, yeah, there are diets that we can choose that will in general lead to a more or less inflammatory status in our body. But that mm-hmm. doesn't have anything to do with what you only ate at a single meal. That is the aggregate of your total pattern of what you're eating, which circles all the way back to the very first thing that you said, which is, a diet is meant to be your pattern of eating, not
yeah.
what is exactly on my plate in a single meal. And that mm-hmm. if it's a little bit outside of the norm of, or whatever diet rules existed, that you've failed.
Yeah. And I think outside of therapeutic diets, which we talked about a little bit at the beginning, diets that I don't even like to use that terminology with clients, unless we're doing like a therapeutic diet or mm-hmm. something, or talking about fad diets, because I think it gives them the wrong impression of, all right, we're going to be regimented about this. We're going to think mm-hmm. really hard about what we're eating, what we're putting in our body every meal. Whereas I want them to start to think about the habits that they're forming, even if it's not even just about what the foods we're eating. What if it's around like mealtimes and the way we're interacting with our food environment, a lot of things.
Right.
But I want you to think about your pattern of eating and foods that you can incorporate in to your pattern of eating that make you feel good, that we know that are supportive of overall health, that maybe help address some markers that exist within your body, like something like, if we're dealing like high cholesterol, high triglycerides, something like that, things that we could add in versus going the restrictive route and saying, mm-hmm. all right, now I have this like regimented protocol that I have to follow where I have to cut out all of these foods and I can't ever eat cake again.
Right.
I usually approach talking about someone's diet or eating pattern from a, what can we add in here mm-hmm. versus what can we remove?
And I don't know if you remember this, but I, you probably do. I went through a small phase where my LDL cholesterol was elevated. Mm-hmm. I was also going through a very stressful time in my life, but I remember coming to work, and of course, Jesse is queen of fiber. So I was like, okay, help me brainstorm like some ways that I can add in fiber into my life. And I remember coming back to work maybe a day or two later. And I was like, I literally am so full. Like I can't get to this number of grams of fiber because I am so full right now. But that is totally the opposite approach than, mm-hmm. oh my gosh, I had this was the first high cholesterol reading I've ever had in my life. I don't have a genetic predisposition, so there was something I could do about it. And instead of coming from the perspective of, oh my gosh, I have to cut all these things out, just the simple like brainstorming session that I had with you of like, what are some creative ways I can get fiber into my diet? I was like, I literally don't even have time to eat these other foods because I'm trying to get so much fiber into my diet. And that is, again, the end goal, is that we're trying to figure out how to make sure you're nourished, how you're mm-hmm. comfortable, right? Like, that wasn't uncomfortable for me. I wasn't coming back a couple of days later and being like, man, I'm starving. I can't figure out what to eat. In fact, yeah. I had the exact opposite problem. So I just think it's interesting when I'm working with clients or when I have situations like that, and they, for the first time ever, are experiencing that, that they're on the other end of that spectrum. They're like, I don't know how to fit all these things in.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's a much better approach mentally. People handle psychologically adding in foods much better than feeling restricted and having to take things away. So there's a little bit of a psychological aspect to the way that we implement that, because I mean, if you think about it, I'm sure everyone that's listening has been on some form of restrictive diet at some point in their life, or has cut something out at any point in their life, where once you cut those things out, your desire to consume them only becomes stronger. And mm-hmm. so when you label something as bad or as toxic or as off limits, you only want those foods more, for the most mm-hmm. part, you know, unless those foods are making you feel really crappy. And for some reason, you know, if we have a food sensitivity or intolerance to it, and all of a sudden we cut out a food that makes us feel much better, then maybe we don't have the drive to eat those. But
that is the stereotypical story of a child, right? We think that's obvious when we're talking about children. Well, don't tell them what to do, because then they're going to do the exact opposite of what you're asking them to do. I mean, the same thing goes for, even though we think we're very grown up and very different, I mean, the underlying psychology of it is that our brain is still very similar. So as soon as you're told no, it's like, what? No, yeah, I want to do
that. But I want to do it now.
That's the one I want to
touch the big red button.
Oh, God.
But kind of going along those lines, what do you feel like are some things that you see with diets or eating patterns that work for people? What are some other things that you see that you find work well for people or are desirable with diets, quote unquote?
Yeah, I think that a big thing that I see that is probably one of the most meaningful things I think that clients find me emphasizing to them is, let's figure out how to fit in the foods that are meaningful to you. And mm-hmm. sometimes that means that those foods fall into a category that maybe the rest of the world says is bad or unhealthy. But it has some sort of deeper, like, cultural meaning, right? Like, there's something their grandmother made it when they were growing up, or, you know, as part of a certain holiday that was all this, it always included this. And so I think one thing that is desirable is to try and, like, take the categories off, especially when it comes to cultural foods that have a lot of meaning for whatever. And that's different for every single person. But finding the foods that have a lot of meaning and then saying, no, we're going to be intentional about keeping those things in your diet, and we can find other ways, you know, to balance. It's all about balance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. An individual's eating pattern should allow for a lot of flexibility. Mm-hmm. It should allow for you to go out and eat with a friend. It should allow for you to go to a birthday party and have cake. It should allow for you to engage in activities that are meaningful for you. And it should allow you to show up in your life as a fueled individual with, mm-hmm. you know, mental clarity, because you're feeding yourself. And I think a lot of times fad diets get away from that. You feel really crappy because you don't have energy, because you're not eating. You can't go out and you can't socialize with your friends, or, you know, can't have cake at the birthday party, can't go to the cookout, can't do all of these things. And so that then even adds additional layer of isolation with dieting, which then puts you down a slippery slope to development of an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. Because one thing that's hallmark with eating disorders, if your personality is right and there's a perfect storm and you've started a diet and you start to get to that isolation bit, it's very easy to fall down the rabbit hole and fall down that slope pretty quickly. And so I think one characteristic of an eating pattern or diet that I look for people to have is that flexibility, and that food is adding to their life and adding to their mental clarity versus distracting from it. And your thoughts should not center around food 24/7.
And that actually is another good point, because I think that another piece of that is the satisfaction piece, because the flexibility almost sets you up to be able to be satisfied because you can listen to yourself. You know that you'll have things available at other times of the day or other times of the year. You know, your body is able to kind of take a step back and say, like, yeah, I actually feel really satisfied right now. And it's not forward thinking like, well, but what if I don't have this next time? Or what if we decide next week we're not allowed to eat cake again? And those types of things. And then there's also the satisfaction that comes from the social component of eating, right? If you're becoming more isolated because of these diets, you also are not getting the relational satisfaction of seeing your friends, seeing your family. Mm-hmm. And that also will make you hyper-focus onto the food.
Yeah. And you and I know for a fact, we both teach about it in nutrition, and that like your pattern of eating is not only the food you eat, it's your environment that you interact with. It's influenced, the foods that you choose to eat is influenced by social, cultural cues. It's huge versus just, I know I need to eat this, so I'm going to eat this. It's not that simple.
Right.
And so I think a lot of times fad diets and very strict diets that we wouldn't recommend for people lose that. They teach you that that's not something, that food is only fuel. And it's a very toxic way to look at food, because food is much more than just fuel for our body. I think we can appreciate that food is absolutely fuel, but it is not only fuel. And it's a way that we connect with people. It's a way that we form relationships. It's a way that we, you know, it has so many different things.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think I would agree that the piece that is more rigid, that characteristic that is so rigid, that's the piece that is the least desirable about, you know, like if someone is feeling really rigid or feeling guilt or shame for even putting something in their mouth or having something on a grocery list, even that's the part that is what we try, what I, with my clients and with the students that I teach and stuff, try to stay away from.
Yeah. So I want to, just thinking about like providing a little bit more value to people listening, is what are some things that individuals can do to like build a healthy eating pattern, build a healthy plate? What are some things that we as dietitians would, as we work one-on-one with clients or individuals or teach our students, what do we look for to encourage people to add in? Because we're certainly not telling people like, yes, you need to eat cake 3 times a day and that's all you need to eat. So what are some things that we generally kind of recommend?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. My favorite thing for those that are listening, I know we gave a little bit of background on the first one, but I work a lot with families, young children. And my most favorite go-to is looking at, instead of the food that's on the plate, we look at what the food contains. So carb, fat, protein, and fiber. Because parents always love to ask like, well, what happens when my child asks for Doritos for dinner? I'm like, okay, all right, let's take a step back and neutralize, because Doritos have carbohydrates in them, but we don't have any fat, we don't have any fiber, we don't have any protein, okay?
Yeah.
So in order to make a complete meal, we actually need to, if the parent is okay with that being part of the dinner plate, right? We include that and, right? It's a yes and. It's not well, only this fits. It's trying as much as possible to do yes and. So those four big macro, well, fiber isn't technically a macro by itself, but getting the carbohydrates, fats, proteins, and fibers at any snack or meal, and removing the judgment of where said carbohydrate, protein, fat, or fiber comes from.
Yeah.
Is a big one that I feel like my clients benefit a lot from. And the kids, I mean, as soon as their parents are like, sure, we can have Doritos with dinner, they're like, really? And it can neutralize foods in a very powerful way for kids, that it's like, oh, okay. And now it's like, there's no fighting.
Yeah. Yeah. And they probably, with allowing that at a meal, that goes back to the psychology of like, if you're told you can't have it, you only want it more. Mm-hmm. If you're told that you can have it, you realize like, maybe I don't really want that all the time. Maybe that doesn't actually taste as good as I thought it does. Or maybe that doesn't feel as good in my body as I want it. You know, they can start kind of making some of those connections, whether you're a child or an adult.
Yeah.
So yeah, I kind of follow the same thing. As I think it's really meaningful for people to think about carbs, protein, fat, fiber. Again, with fiber falling technically a carbohydrate, but we think of it differently because it acts much differently than just a standard carbohydrate within the body. And so ideally we're, you know, throughout the week, we're making sure that we're including some fruits and vegetables and whole grains and legumes and lean proteins and things like that. But usually that just focusing on, do we have a carb source, fat, fiber, protein? Because those macronutrients work very synergistically together, and it's very important to have them together. I think we can appreciate that if we just ate carbohydrates, we would probably feel pretty crappy a few hours after eating, because what's going to happen is our glucose is going to spike, and then it's going to crash really quickly. And we're going to feel that crash and that energy burn and feel that slump. But if we add a fat and if we add some protein in there, we're digesting things a little bit more slowly. Blood glucose doesn't spike as much. We stay a little bit fuller longer, especially if we have some of that fiber. And so it's really understanding how these things pair synergistically.
Right.
And then we do a lot of education on what foods contain what. So like what contains protein? What are good options for protein? Especially like if you don't like meat or if you purposely don't consume meat for any reason, there are great sources of plant protein that we can include. The importance of making sure that we have fat when we're consuming things like veggies, because we have fat soluble vitamins that exist within our veggies and that helps us absorb those. And so, it's really, I take a very basic approach in terms of what works for people, because we want to still give that flexibility of like, if you focus on having a carb, fat, protein, and fiber at most meals and choosing fruits and veggies and whole grains when you can, like more often than not, you're going to be fine.
Yeah.
And yeah, there are things that we can do from a therapeutic standpoint to like address some health concerns and stuff. But for most people, if they started with that, they probably see benefits to their health and mental and physical.
Yeah. And I think too, that the mental stress or burden that comes with trying to stay in the box, so to say, like if there's a fad, that also has a weight that we have to consider with all of our choices, right? I mean, goodness, if you want to go have an ice cream cone with your friends, the isolation, the guilt, the all of that comes with saying like, oh, I don't really know if I can do that, can be far more detrimental. Is it every time that we say, every single meal that we say yes and eat the ice cream? Probably not. But the times that it's meaningful, right? And and that's where the balance comes in.
Yeah, absolutely. So to kind of wrap it up, this has been kind of a fun talk. I like venting about diets and talk. And any day. So yeah, if you, Hope and I really started this podcast because we were like, we have these conversations and we rant about stuff all the time. We might as well record it.
Yes.
But to kind of wrap up, where can people find us if they want to learn more?
Yeah.
And yeah.
And these are the types of things we turn into resources on GroveNutritionCollective.com. Things like handouts, short videos, so if you go to our website, GroveNutritionCollective.com, there is a free option. There is a paid option. And it's going to give you things like recipes. It's going to be broken down into different categories, gut health, allergies, general well-being. And we really just try to break this information down and make it a little bit more accessible, hopefully a lot more accessible, even if it's just a little bit, though, that's okay. And that's where we hope that we can connect with this community further.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us today. Until next time, stay responsibly caffeinated and reasonably skeptical of nutrition and health claims that you see online. We'll see you next time.
See you next time.